Introduction to the Physics of Sin. If you want kind of a more in-depth approach, if you go to our reasons.org website, you'll see a transcript of a talk I gave at Cambridge University a couple of summers ago. But this is an introduction. And it's also going to be the title of a book we'll be bringing out in a couple of years' time. Which reminds me, our latest book from Reasons to Believe came out just this week, Who is Adam? On Human Origins. I think we have some copies at the back table if you want it. And the good news was, I think it was last Tuesday, it hit number 5 on the Amazon nonfiction bestseller list. So, very good. So, but this will be another forthcoming book down the road from Reasons to Believe. And my wife encouraged me to strip it of all differential equations, so this will be an equation-free talk tonight. So, the book will have some equations in it, but this will have no equations. So it was really difficult. I really wanted to put Maxwell's entropy equations in there, but no, I managed to get them out. So, an introduction to the physics of sin. Now, in terms of the universe and sin, it all harkens back to what happened in the Garden of Eden. You know, our first parents, Adam and Eve, were enjoying paradise. And then they rebelled against their creator. And so a major debate within the Christian community is what exactly happened in the Garden of Eden when Adam rebelled against the authority of his creator. What happened to him? What happened to his progeny? What happened to life? And what happened to physics? And what's physics got to do with sin anyway? Well, there's six things that we note are consequences of Adam's sin. The obvious consequence was that paradise was lost. Adam and Eve were kicked out of the Garden of Eden, and you know the story. There was a couple of angels with flaming swords that blocked access to that garden, and in particular to the Tree of Life. And with access to the Tree of Life blocked, Adam and Eve experienced death. Now, it wasn't just spiritual death where they lost their relationship with the Creator. That's what spiritual death is. It's losing that relationship we have with the Creator. And Adam lost that immediately when he rebelled against his Creator. It was instantaneous where he had that loss. As it tells us in the text, there was shame that came over Adam and Eve, a symptom of that broken relationship with their Creator. And that is spiritual death. And that spiritual death was passed on to all the progeny of Adam and Eve. But as a result of that spiritual death, came physical death. Now, this is explained in more depth in Romans 5. I'll get to that text in a few minutes. But first came spiritual death, later came physical death. And then we see the curse being laid out to Adam and Eve. The first thing God shares with Adam is, because of what you had done, cursed will be the ground because of you. And this is really where a lot of the debate goes on. Exactly what does the text mean that the ground is cursed on account of Adam's sin? Well, it spells it out. Now, the text tells us that in the Garden of Eden, things were beautiful. The garden grew according to God's plan. Now, Adam will be tossed out of the garden, and outside the garden, there are thorns and thistles. Again, a big part of the debate is, were there thorns and thistles outside of Eden before Adam's sin, or has that always been the condition of planet Earth? And then Adam is also told that from now on, his work will bring painful toil. Now, he did work inside the Garden of Eden, but as he tended the garden, it was a work that brought great joy to Adam. And now Adam is told by his Creator, you will continue to work, but your work is not going to be as pleasant as it was in the past. There will be painful toil. And then he tells the woman that she will now experience increased pain in childbirth. There was pain before, but now we're being told that the pain will be increased. And then the last consequence is often missed as people go through Genesis chapter 3. There's a warning at the end of that chapter that because of the sin that Adam and Eve have committed against their Creator, there will be ongoing conflict and tension between men and women in marriage relationships and between parents and their children in the family relationships. So there'll be these conflicts. So these are the on-the-surface consequences that are laid out in the text. But we're going to get into exactly what the physics is all about as to what these consequences exactly mean. Now, again, the big part of the debate is that there are numerous Christians and denominations who believe that when Adam sinned, That's when the laws of physics radically changed. In the Garden of Eden, there was perfection. And with sin, Adam and Eve were cast out of the garden, and suddenly we're faced with a very different world, a very different universe. Well, a couple of texts I'd like to take you to that suggest that that interpretation cannot possibly be correct. First, Jeremiah 33:25. Jeremiah tells us the laws that govern the heavens and the earth are fixed. These laws that are governing the heavens and the earth are the laws of physics. That's what physicists define to be the natural laws, those laws that determine the behavior of the heavens and the earth. And Jeremiah tells us that they're fixed. They're unchangeable. They have not changed. Then in Romans 8:20-22, we're told that the entire creation is subject to frustration. In particular, it's subject to this law of decay. Now, you don't have to have taken graduate physics to realize what this law of decay is referring to. You know, anyone who's gotten past the eighth grade realizes that this law of decay is a reference to what we call Murphy's Law, the law of disorder, entropy, the second law of thermodynamics, which simply states that things will get worse if you just leave them alone. Now, it's the closet principle. You've got a closet, you've got a garage, you've got an attic. If you do nothing to that closet, attic, or garage, it will become more disordered and chaotic as the time goes by. And the entire universe behaves that way. Now, Romans 8:20-22, making reference to the entire universe being subject to this law of decay until the fulfillment of the sons of God, a reference to the time in the future when the fullness of those who will come to faith in Jesus Christ will be reached. Up until that time, the entire universe is subject to this law of decay. There have been those Christians who speculated that maybe this simply refers to the entirety of the universe as it stands right now. And this is where we can come in with 21st century in physics and say, no, that can't work. Why? Because when God created the universe, He not only created matter and energy, He created space and time. And there are passages in the Bible that tell us that space, time, matter, energy are not separable. And indeed, 20th and 21st century physics confirm that it's impossible to separate these entities from one another. In particular, you cannot separate the time dimension of the universe from the space dimensions. In fact, when we physicists try to lay out the geometry of the universe, we refer to it as the four space-time system, length, width, height, and time, where time actually mathematically behaves like a fourth dimension of space. It's impossible to separate the time dimension from the space dimensions. And in that context, when Romans 8:20-22 talks about the entirety of the universe, that means it refers to the entirety of space and time, which takes us all the way back to Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. This is that moment when God brought into existence for the first time, space and time. Now, this is important in a larger evangelistic context. If you wanted to put the religions of the world into two camps, there is one group of religions that say that there is a God or a creative force out there. But it's a God or a creative force that works within space and time that are considered to be infinite, always existing, and absolute. The Eastern religions, for example, fall into that category. Where the Bible stands apart from all other holy books, all other books that make the foundations of religions of the world, it's the only holy book that says when God creates, He created space and time. It's not a God that creates within space and time, but a God who created outside or independent of space and time itself. Now, this theme that the laws of physics are fixed from the moment of creation until the completion of the number of sons and daughters that will come to faith in Jesus Christ is found not only in Jeremiah 33 and Romans 8, you can find indications of it as well in the book of Genesis. What does it tell us in the book of Genesis? It tells us that the sun and the stars were shining before Adam and Eve were created, before Adam and Eve had rebelled against their Creator. And quite clearly, the Bible in Job and Psalms tells us that the sun and stars were shining after Adam and Eve rebelled against their Creator. Now, that's an important point from the standpoint of 21st century physics. Because physicists, starting in about the 1958, or Martin Schwarzschild, the famous astrophysicist, worked out the physics of how stars burn. And what he discovered is that even the tiniest changes in the laws of physics would mean that stars would never form in cosmic history, or they would form and instantly explode. It was actually the beginning of what astronomers call the anthropic principle. And we look out at the universe, we see it's exquisitely designed, fine-tuned, to make life possible. And the first inkling we had of that was Martin Schwarzschild's analysis that showed us that even the tiniest changes in any of the fundamental forces of physics means you will not get stable burning stars, and if you don't have stable burning stars, life is impossible anytime, anywhere in the universe. Well, the point here is the Bible tells us there were stars before, there were stars after, and therefore the physics can't be any different today than it was before Adam and Eve rebelled against their Creator. And you say, what kind of changes are you talking about? Well, what Martin Schwarzschild determined was if you were to change, for example, the ratio of the gravitational force to the electromagnetic force by as little as one part in 10,000 trillion, 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 there'd be no possibility for life anytime, anywhere in the universe. So we're talking extremely tiny changes, which essentially tells us that physics is fixed or constant, as Jeremiah declared. Now, we can draw the same conclusion by noting that Genesis chapter 1 tells us, and 2, that animals and human beings were eating before Adam sinned against his Creator. You see that in both Genesis 2 and Genesis 1, and clearly they're eating now. Well, the point here is similar to the burning of stars, is that the digestion of food, where we take food in and convert that food into energy that allows us to perform useful work with our bodies, likewise is incredibly sensitive to even the tiniest changes in the laws of physics. You'd be amazed at just how the different elements in the atomic chart, their nuclear ground state energy levels, for example, all to be exquisitely fine-tuned just to make it possible for you to eat your food. Likewise, the gravity, electromagnetism, or the strong or weak nuclear forces were changed by the slightest amount, we would not be able to digest food and perform work. Well, we could, but our bodies would instantly explode, or we wouldn't be able to make any use of that energy at all. So, star burning and food metabolism or digestion are extremely sensitive to even the tiniest changes in the physical laws. Now, for the skeptic, a question that is often raised, and I've had this raised at seminaries when I've talked about this, does nature's record reveal any discontinuity from no death and no decay to death and decay? Because what's going on is there are denominations, whole denominations, that hold this view that before Adam sinned, there was no death whatsoever and there was no decay. Does physics have the capacity to actually address that question? I'm going to argue that Scripture addresses the question. But science also gives us an answer to this question. And the answer comes out of the fact in science that astronomers directly witness the past. Now, I constantly remind my wife that as an astronomer, I'm completely ignorant of what's going on right now. We astronomers only observe the past. For example, when we look up at the moon, that's physics 1.5 seconds ago, because it took the light 1.5 seconds to reach our eyes. When we look at the sun, well, that's 8.25 minutes ago. And so we're seeing the sun not as it is right now, but as it was 8.25 minutes ago. Or to push that a little bit further, you can see the Andromeda Galaxy tonight with your naked eye. And looking at the Andromeda Galaxy, you're looking at an object that's 2.1 million light years away, which means you don't see Andromeda as is today. You're seeing it as it was 2.1 million years ago. And so astronomy is that one discipline, thanks to the finite velocity of light, where we get to directly witness the past. And just a little aside here, this is the reason why it's in astronomy, amongst all the sciences, where we're getting the strongest evidences scientifically for the God of the Bible creating the universe and all life. Why? It's that one science where you can go back in time and see what God has done in creating. In fact, I'll just give you another little tidbit. There's only one moment in the history of the universe where astronomers can look back and see all the way to the creation of the universe itself. And one of the things that really encourages me as I go through Scripture and look at the stars and galaxies is to realize God created us at the only moment in cosmic history when we get to see the entire history of the universe from the creation event forward. So we actually can watch God create the universe. We can look back to that moment, for example, when light first separated from darkness. And we can take a picture of that moment when light first separated from darkness. If you want to see that picture, I don't have it up here, but there's a book on the table back there called The Creator and the Cosmos. And you can actually see the image that astronomers have taken of that early moment of creation. Well, the bottom line here, as we go back in time, back into the time when Moses lived, we go back to the time of Abraham, back to the time of Adam, and earlier than Adam, do we see any discontinuities in the physics? The answer is, we see none. We see no discontinuities. As we look in the past and measure the physics we see in the past is identical to the physics we see today. Now, that's through direct observation. I can give you the same answer through theory. An answer comes with something I've already mentioned, the anthropic principle. When we astronomers look out at the universe, we see it has hundreds of fine-tuned characteristics. What I mean by fine-tuning is where they have to be adjusted so that there's not too big and not too small, but just right. Hundreds of characteristics of the universe have to be tuned to just right values to make life possible. And part of this anthropic principle is that life would be impossible anytime, anywhere in the universe if any of the laws or constants of physics were to change in any significant way. So there's a condition for life to exist in the universe, for example, the velocity of light be no different in the past than it was today, that the fine structure constants be no different in the past than they were today, because if they were, none of us would be here to talk to one another or observe the universe. Now, this challenges a very popular interpretation that we see in Romans 5:12. And this is that passage in the book of Romans where Paul talks about how because of Adam's offense in the Garden of Eden, death came into the world. Now, what the text really says is this, that death through sin was visited upon all men, and by the way, it does not exclude the women. It's a generic term, men, women, and children. That death through sin was visited upon all men. Now, the point here is that Paul, who's writing this passage, is very carefully qualifying what he means by the death that Adam brought about. In fact, if you go through the entire book of Romans, you'll notice that he addresses four different kinds of death. So whenever you read Romans and see Paul talking about death, it's important to ask, what kind of death, Paul, are you addressing here and now? In this case, he helps explain it. He says, number one, it's a death you get through sin. Well, the important distinction there's only one species of life on planet Earth that's capable of dying through sin. There's only one species that's capable of experiencing sin or doing sin, and that's the human species. As the Bible tells us in Genesis chapter 1, God made three different kinds of life. Life that's purely physical, life that's physical and soulish, like the birds and mammals with mind, will, and emotions, but only one species that's in the image of God, body, soul, and spirit. And it's that body, soul, and spirit which gives us the capacity to sin, to rebel against the authority of our Creator. And so there's nothing in Romans 5:12 that tells us that there wasn't animal death or plant death before Adam offended God in the Garden of Eden. And this theme is brought out again by Paul in 1 Corinthians 15. In fact, there are only two passages in the Bible that directly deal with this issue of what kind of death Adam brought about. But likewise, it tells us in 1 Corinthians 15 that this is a death that comes upon human beings only, not plants, not animals, this is humans. And so, yes, Adam brought about death, but he brought about the death of the human species. And as Romans 5:12 to 21 explains, he brought about spiritual death first, and a consequence of that spiritual death was physical death. Now, that gives us an interesting insight on the physics of sin that I may not get time to discuss tonight. But if indeed physical death was a consequence of Adam's rebellion against God, is it possible that there's something in our experience of physical death that has a significant role in bringing about the conquest of sin and evil and suffering? I argue that it very much is. That it's a good thing that we all go through physical death. The consequence of not going through physical death is that we would be in the same spot as the demons, where they rebelled against God and was a permanent rebellion where no redemption was possible. Because of physical death, not only because of physical death, but partly because of the physical death that we all experience, there is an opportunity for us to be redeemed from the consequences of spiritual death. So death is important, and death is good. And I think that's what's really behind a lot of this teaching in the church today, that death was brought about by Adam generically to all life, and this is bad in all contexts. I don't think that's the way Scripture treats this subject. That yes, death is unpleasant, but there's something valuable and very good in a death that we all experience. And I believe that's true not just for those who are righteous and receiving salvation, but it's also true even those who are caught in the rebellion and are headed towards the lake of fire. Even in their case, this death has benefit and reward. I won't go into that either. If you want to pick up that theme, it's covered in this book, Beyond the Cosmos. Genesis 2:16, I think, is germane to this point, because it's this text that tells us that God placed Adam in the Garden of Eden. In other words, there's a big difference between the way God created Adam and the way he created Eve. Eve was created in the Garden of Eden. Adam was created outside the Garden of Eden and placed in the Garden of Eden, which means that unlike Eve, Adam knew what conditions were like outside the Garden of Eden. Eve had never seen that or experienced it, but Adam had, which I think is one reason why Adam held Adam to account. He knew where Eve did not, and so he was held responsible. And you can see some evidence for this also in Genesis 2, because God gives Adam a warning that in the day that you eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you will die that very day. And that's what happened. When Adam rebelled against God, he instantly lost his relationship with his Creator and experienced spiritual death, which led to physical death. But notice that God does not in any way try to define or explain this death to Adam. Adam knew what death was all about. He had seen it outside the garden. And so when God taught him about death, he knew. Now Eve, she'd be shaking her head and saying what you're talking about, but not in the case of Adam. Adam knew. He knew what was going on. And then Genesis 1, 24-25 gives us an interesting insight. Because in this text, it talks about God creating on creation day 6 two kinds of animals. Animals that are wild, that is difficult to tame. Then it talks about the cattle of the field that are easy to tame. And how God created these two different kinds of land mammals to serve humanity. Thank you. Now, they serve humanity in one way it's obvious and one way that's not so obvious. The cattle of the field, that's obvious in the sense that those are those creatures that we use to support our agricultural economy. The sheep, the goats, the horses, the cows. And they are not wild like the other creatures the text is talking about, in the sense that it's relatively easy to tame goats and sheep and deer and cows and horses. I grew up in Canada. And when you're climbing in the mountains of Canada, the thing you've got to watch out for is that goats are going to come right up to you and start eating your clothes and your backpack, etc. They have no fear. And you can tame them within a couple of minutes. And you can do that with a lot of the other, quote, beasts of the field. They are easy to tame. And because they're easy to tame, they make excellent agricultural creatures. They're herbivores, so they're not expensive to feed. Just let them eat the grass. And then they don't mind being herded and kept by humans. So they make excellent creatures for our agricultural system. And God intended all along that we would make use of these creatures. But in a contrast, that with the land mammals that are wild. And this is a reference to those creatures that are difficult to tame. Now, what are the difficult to tame land mammals? Well, the hippo, yeah, he's territorial. But you can actually tame a hippo if you get to them away from their other hippos and they get them young enough. But in terms of the difficult to tame creatures, you can put all the carnivores into that category. Whether it be an eagle, whether it be a wolf or a cat, they're difficult to tame. And again, I grew up in Canada, and I would often have, as I was walking to the telescope there, these pack of wolves that would follow me. But I could not get close to them. They weren't like the goats where you could start petting them right away. You don't pet a wild wolf right away. It takes time. Now, once they get to know you, after 6 months, 9 months, or 12 months, then you can get close to them. But it takes time. They're difficult to tame. But there's something wonderful about these wild carnivore mammals. They make very good household pets. If you take the trouble to tame them, you can bring them into your home, and they will not only make great pets, they'll entertain you, and you can housebreak them. I mean, bringing a cow into your living room is really not a good idea. No matter what you do, you'll not be able to housebreak that cow. And it doesn't make a very good pet for your children. Why? Because it's got to eat almost all of its waking hours. It just spends all of its time digesting food. And that has certain consequences that are unpleasant. And because of the fact that they're spending all this time digesting their food, they're really not free to entertain your family and your children. The carnivores are great. We've got carnivores in our home. You know, their feeding time measures about, maybe 2 minutes max per day. So in 2 minutes, they've got their calories all consumed, and the rest of the time, they're free to entertain us, and they're easy to housebreak. They make great pets. Well, my point is this. God, long before the fall, long before Adam's rebellion, intended that we would have this panoply of creatures that would not only serve us economically, but provide us with enjoyment in our homes and elsewhere. So what does this tell us? From a biblical perspective, there was no change in the laws of physics at the fall. On the other hand, as Romans 8 indicates, there will come a time when this law of decay, and by the way, the interesting thing about the law of decay, it actually ties into all the other laws of physics. So in that sense, the Bible really identified the most fundamental law of physics, this law of decay, the second law of thermodynamics. The law that says that things will progress from order to disorder or order to chaos. The universe is running down. Well, that ties into the law of gravity, ties into electromagnetism and the strong and weak nuclear force and the other constants of physics. It really is fundamental. And Romans 8 tells us this law will remain until the fullness of the sons and daughters of God are brought to fulfillment, until God is brought to fulfillment, all the people he intends to bring to faith in Jesus Christ. But once that has been achieved, then we're told there will be radical changes in the laws of physics. When does that happen? Right after the Great White Throne Judgment. At the Great White Throne Judgment, Revelation 20, we have Jesus Christ personally bringing to an end, final end, of all evil and sin in his entire creation. This is when he pronounces judgment on those who want to persist in their rebellion against them, and they're cast out of God's creation into the lake of fire. It's a prison house where no one can escape, and the rest of creation is totally free of sin and evil from that point onward. You say, what about all the sin and evil we have? Well, there's a great white throne judgment of a sense that we see described in 1 Corinthians 3. And it's not so much a judgment for all the bad things we've done. It's basically an award ceremony where the Lord hands out his rewards to those who've chosen to follow him. But it also tells us that in that reward ceremony that he will consume away everything that displeases him that's within us. So we walk into the new creation completely free of sin and evil. All that within us will be consumed, will be burnt out of us. And we go into the new creation with the rewards that he bestows. Or to put it another way, you know, I remember years ago when I was a minister of evangelism here in this church, we would take whole bunches of you and we would go door to door and just share our faith in Jesus Christ with people. But one of the things we did in going door to door, just ask people questions about how they think it is that God will judge them when they come to the end of their life. And it's amazing how frequently you get this answer. We saw it in 19 out of 20 cases. That way God's going to judge, it's going to be good deeds versus bad deeds. And my good deeds outweigh my bad deeds. I get to go to heaven. If they don't, I go to hell. Well, what are we told in 2 Corinthians 3, 1 Corinthians 3, and Revelation 20, and particularly Ezekiel? Three great sermons that Ezekiel preaches makes the point that, yes, God will weigh you in the balance. But before he weighs you in the balance, he will ask the question, did you submit your life to my control and make me the boss of your life, your personal Lord and Savior? The answer to that question is yes. He takes the two pans that are going to be weighed in the balance, and the one that has all the bad deeds in it, he dumps it. So it's empty. Then he weighs you in the balance. Good deeds versus nothing. But for the one who answers no to that question, he takes that side of the scale that has all the good deeds in it, and he dumps it. Then he weighs you in the balance. It's bad deeds versus zero. And of course, what you see in the book of Ezekiel is the self-righteous Jews out there scream at Ezekiel and say God's ways aren't fair. But Ezekiel reminds them of what a prophet before him said in the book of Isaiah, chapter 64. All of your righteous deeds are like filthy rags in my nostrils. Making a reference to those people who are performing good works, not to glorify God, but to glorify themselves or a human institution. And what does Isaiah tell us? The worst sin you can commit is a sin of pride. So he says, rather than count those good deeds against you, I'll simply forget them. And I'll weigh you in the balance. God's ways are fair. I'm a little bit off the subject here. But the laws of physics radically change once evil and sin are completely removed. Now, what about this place called paradise? There's this problem within the Christian community of viewing Garden of Eden as something that encompassed the entire planet, if not the whole universe. But if you go just a couple of chapters past Genesis 2, you run into Genesis 4. And this is where God is dealing with Cain. And what does it tell us about Cain? That he was banished to the land of Nod, which was east of Eden. Which tells us that the Garden of Eden could not have encompassed the entire planet. It's got to be a relatively small locale. And actually, if you go back to Genesis 2, that's fairly clear. Why it talks about four rivers that flow through this location. So how could it be global if there's reference to all this geography that's in one place, the Tigris and the Euphrates, and the other two rivers that can't be identified? It also tells us in Genesis 2 that Adam was created outside the Garden of Eden and that Eve had only seen Eden. So these are three indications that the Garden of Eden was a local paradise on a world that had very different conditions than what was inside the Garden of Eden. And in that sense, what we notice here is that Adam and Eve were in this very pleasant place that God had prepared for them. And part of the curse that he pronounced on them was, well, I'll let you live in my garden. Now you can leave and plant your own garden. This is a garden that he had planted for them. Now he says, you've got to do it yourself. And there's something beautiful in that, in trying to bring us into redemption. Now, there are those who point out, Genesis 1, when it talks about the creation days, we see repeated five times the statement, it is good. It is good, it is good, it is good, it is good. And finally it says, it is very good. Doesn't this imply that the original creation was perfect? Well, it does in one sense. Notice that the text did not say that this creation was perfect. It simply said that it was good and it was very good. But I would agree that it's perfect in the context of the conquest of evil. That we live in a universe, a creation, that God had created in advance to be the best possible creation, the perfect creation, to bring about the final conquest of sin and evil. So in that sense, this creation we live in today is perfect. It was perfect before paradise, it's perfect after paradise. It's the same universe. Laws of physics haven't changed. It still has those perfect attributes to bring about this conquest of evil. And that's really where you get into the advanced course on the physics of sin. Why is it perfect for the conquest of evil? I'll give you a little bit of that in a few minutes. But as you get to the last two chapters of the Bible, it tells us that God will take us into a new creation, and the former creation will pass away. It will vanish. It will disappear. As God spoke this universe into existence, He will speak it out of existence once evil has been finally conquered, and will replace it with a brand new universe. And as you read Revelation 21 and 22, you cannot help but go away with the conclusion that this new creation is far superior in every way to this creation, far superior to anything that existed in paradise. And again, if I were to compare the Christian faith with the rest of the religions of the world, this is something I noticed when I was just 17, kind of going through the different religions. All the religions, except for that based on the Bible, teach the same thing. I found it amazing that every religion has got a Garden of Eden story in it, every single one. They all talk about how humanity began in a paradisical state. They all also agree with one another that humanity lost paradise. So there's something about the memory of human origins that permeates into all the religions of the world, that we were in paradise and we lost it. But where these other religions differ from Christianity is that they teach that God or the gods are on a mission to restore us to paradise. What's distinct about the Bible is it tells us that God's on a mission to deliver us from the enslavement of paradise. Say, how can you refer to the Garden of Eden and paradise as a place of enslavement? Well, we'll be getting to that in a few minutes. It's enslavement because of the physics that existed there. We are bound by the physics of the universe. That's part of what Romans 8 is talking about. The entire creation is subject to this law of decay, and everything, the human species, all life, all the stars and galaxies, are bound, are enslaved by the physics that rules this universe of space-time, matter, and energy. Well, let me give you just a little introduction to what I believe is the ultimate purpose of the physical laws. Now, you could argue that these laws of physics are designed the way they are by God to provide us with this beautiful home we call planet Earth. That would be correct. You could also argue, based on Psalm 19 and Psalm 50 and Psalm 97, that God designed the physics of the universe in such a way that we could see His glory in creating it on our behalf. The heavens declare the righteousness of God. They declare the glory of God, the power of God, and the love of God. And you heard me say a little bit earlier, God has placed us at that one time in cosmic history, 13.7 billion years after the creation event, that one moment when you can actually see the entirety of the creation history of the universe. Not too long in the future, we won't be able to do that. God created us any earlier, we wouldn't have been able to do that. Now is the only time. And so part of the physics of the universe is to enable us to witness what God has done in creating this beautiful universe. The other purpose of the physical laws, God has designed the physics of the universe in such a way that it instructs us about Him and His plan of salvation. It instructs the angels. The angels are watching what God has done in the universe to learn about His grace. In fact, you can document about seven different purposes of these laws of physics. But the one I want to talk about tonight, finish up with tonight, is that these laws of physics also have been optimally designed by the Creator to bring us back from our evil ways to submitting to His virtue and His plan of salvation for us. And again, if you consider Genesis chapter 3, cursed is the ground because of you. And then God gets specific with Adam and Eve. He says, from now on, you will experience more work and more pain. And I'm arguing tonight that the laws of physics were designed and advanced by God so that the moment Adam and Eve sinned, from that point forward, if you generalize over all of humanity, the more sin they commit, the more work they have to do, the more sin they commit, the more pain they'll experience. Now, those of us who have been parents, or those of us, for that matter, who have been children raised by parents, so that includes all of us, will note that one of the ways parents discipline their children is that they want to ensure that improper behavior has with it the consequence they're going to experience more pain and more work. I mean, that's how we discipline our kids. you do that, I'm going to make sure you either experience more pain or you're going to get more work, or preferably you're going to get both. So, and we parents do that for our children simply to be consistent with the laws of physics. One of the things I tell my boys is this: if I don't discipline you, physics will. It will step in, and physics is going to be a lot harsher. One of the things about physics is it's utterly consistent. My wife will share with you, one of my problems in disciplining my sons is I'm not consistent. Sometimes I'm too tough on them, sometimes I'm way too easy on them, probably more of the latter than the former. But physics doesn't work that way. And you know, I try to explain to my boys, look, you know, I tend to be a little soft in my discipline, but it's a good idea for you to respond to the discipline I bestow upon you, because physics is a lot harsher. And that's what happens. If parents don't discipline their children, they go out into the world, and the world begins to discipline the physics as well as the people around them that are experiencing that physics. Well, let me give you a few examples of how the physics of the universe, gravity, thermodynamics, electromagnetism, work in such a way to guarantee that the more evil we commit, the more pain we'll experience, and the more work we'll have to do. And since nobody likes pain or work, that's a powerful motivation for them to become more virtuous and less evil, so they can simply avoid pain and work. Aren't we all like that? We all are on a mission to avoid pain and avoid work. Well, as we do that, we discover the path of virtue is much more successful in minimizing pain and work in our life than the path of evil. So something else very important about this, we're going to discover in the process that we don't have the capacity within us to turn from evil and to pursue virtue. We need help. Okay, let me just give you some examples about where physics works in such a way to enhance pain and work when we do things we should not do. Now, I already mentioned to you I got sons. I have two teenage boys, and actually, right now as I'm speaking, our house is filled with about 9 teenage boys. The couple of bands meet in our living room, and so it's quite noisy there. My wife is saying, you know, you get to escape, so, and they come here. But one of the things I noticed is that, you know, my father was a machinist, so I have quite a collection of tools. And the boys all over the neighborhood come over to our house and they borrow my tools. I told them, look, you're free to borrow my tools, but when you're done, put them back. I have a garage and I got a slot for all those tools, and they know where they all go. But, you know, boys are boys. What happens is about 3 weeks later, I'm walking in the backyard and I find all these orange encrusted tools. Okay? They're thoroughly rusted. And so then I have to pick up those orange-encrusted tools and explain to my sons that because of all that crud in those tools, the next time they use those tools, they're not going to work as well for them. They will experience more pain and more work the next time they use those tools. They really don't care about that kind of a sermon, so I got another way of getting the lesson across. I give them each a piece of steel wool and say, I want you to work on this tool until all the orange stuff is gone. Then they really experience a lot of pain and a lot of work in the process. Well, that's one example. I'll give you a second example. I grew up in coastal British Columbia, and I'm old enough that when I was growing up, they would allow the forestry companies to clear cut. In other words, and you know, where I lived, it was all mountains, and the lumber companies would come in, and they would pick a mountain, and they would just strip all the trees off the entire mountain, and they would harvest that lumber. They made a lot of money. But then they discovered that that mountain would not be very productive from that point onward. Why? Because in coastal British Columbia, it rains 200 or 300 inches a year. We just did a little vacation up there, and my wife Kathy was shocked when she asked one of the locals, well, how much rain did you get this season? You know, here we report it in inches. There they report it in meters. They said, well, you know, this year we've only had 4 meters from January to August. We're kind of experiencing a drought. Only 4 meters. Okay. Well, you can imagine what happens when, say, 6 meters of water fall on a steep mountain with no trees on it. It strips all the soil away. 4.5 feet in diameter. It produced about 1,000 pounds of cherries every summer. Beautiful cherries. Fed the whole neighborhood. Well, there was one summer when the owners of that house were gone for the evening.
And there's about 20, 30 kids that descended upon that backyard. We weren't around either. We just saw the aftermath of it. They wanted the cherries, even though they weren't quite ripe yet. And so what they did is they cut the branches off the trees to get the cherries, because they weren't able to climb up to the very edge and get all the cherries. They cut the branches off. Well, they weren't aware that the cherries on a cherry tree grow on the outer branches, not the stuff that's in close to the trunk. They wound up killing the cherry tree. That was the last cherry anyone ever got off that tree. And again, they abuse nature. We were told in Genesis chapter 1, Adam and Eve were instructed, I'm putting you in charge of this planet to manage the resources of the whole planet, not only for your benefit, but for the benefit of all life. Now, I argue this applies even at a sociological level. You know, every one of us in this room has a boss, and our bosses are responsible for us. But one of the things that gives me great comfort as an employee is to realize that my bosses, I got a bunch of bosses, my bosses are highly motivated to take good care of me, because if they don't take good care of me, guess what happens? I will become less productive. And when I become less productive, I don't do as much work. So who's going to get stuck with the work? My bosses will get stuck with the work. Well, I'm also a boss of reasons to believe, and I'm highly motivated to treat our employees and our volunteers well. Why? If I don't treat our employees and our volunteers well, then guess who gets stuck with more work and more pain? So the laws of physics motivate me to take good care of our employees and our volunteers. And for no other reason, I get out of a lot of work and a lot of pain. Matter of fact, just to give you an aside here, we purposely set up reasons to believe 20 years ago that most of the teaching and speaking would be done by our volunteers. So we've always had this principle of raising up volunteers and equipping them to do the speaking and the teaching, at least the bulk of that speaking and teaching. And one of the ways we've been successful is simply by making sure we treat our volunteers well. Some of you have been over at our office and have worked for us. We feed you. You get a free meal when you work at Reasons to Believe. Treat your volunteers well, they come back. If you work them to death and give them no thank you or anything physical, they're not going to come back, and we're not going to get as much work done. Well, I would argue that this applies not just to the laws of physics per se, but the space-time dimensions in which they operate. Remember I told you earlier, it's not possible in the context of 21st century physics that you can separate matter, energy, space, and time. Nor can you separate the laws of physics from space and time. Well, I would argue that space and time have been designed by God to restrain evil and to motivate us to pursue virtue. Well, motivating us to pursue virtue part is a little more difficult to comprehend. I don't think I have time to cover that tonight. But let me show you how the way God has designed time really does rein in the expression of evil by humanity. By the way, the Bible talks about temporality independent of cosmic time. God experiences time, temporal phenomena, relationships, cause and effect, before cosmic time existed. He'll experience it again after cosmic time exists. We're going to go into the new creation where cosmic time will not exist, and yet we'll have temporal relationships with one another. So we need to think of time as something much broader than just what we see applying to the universe. But the time dimension that governs our universe is three properties. It's only one dimension, not like space where you got three dimensions. There's only one dimension. It can't be stopped, and it can't be reversed. Very frustrating for all of us. You cannot reverse the arrow of time. You can't go back. Time only goes forward. Now, if you're very exotic with your physics, you can slow down the passage of time. But that's all you can do. You can never stop it. You can never reverse it. Time inexorably goes forward in one direction only. Well, that has some benefits. Let me just take you back to World War II. We're all aware that because of Hitler's evil, 6.5 million Jews were slaughtered, and there are about 3 million more that were slaughtered by Stalin in the Soviet Union. That's a lot of dead Jews. However, Hitler in the last year of the war finally woke up to the fact that he was losing the war, And as the last few months of the war came to a close, he knew there was no way. And this is when he, in his evil mind, concocted the plan and said, this is all the fault of the German people. It's not my fault, it's the fault of the German people. And they're not worthy to survive my defeat. And so his plan was to bring about the slaughter of 85 million Germans. But because he was confined in time, where time can't be stopped or reversed, and is one dimension, and as we now know, Adolf Hitler, in the last years of his life, had Parkinson's disease, and they didn't have good treatment back then. Even if he had survived the war, he would have only lived about another year. And he knew he had Parkinson's. But his plan was to make sure not one German survived his defeat or his death. He never got to carry out that plan. Why? Because of the way God designed time. And God has done that for all of us. Each one of us can look back in their past life and remember those moments when we wanted to commit a lot more evil than we were able to perpetrate. And we weren't able to pull off all the evil that was in our heart because of the fact that we couldn't get to the people we wanted to do damage to. We couldn't get to them because of the way we were confined in time. Because of our confinement in time, there's a limit to how many people you can get to in the course of a day. That's also true of space. There's a limit to how many people you can get to just because of the fact that God designed the universe to be three very large, rapidly expanding dimensions of space. One of the consequences of living in such a universe is you can only have a limited amount of contact with individuals that are part of the human species. All of us experience the frustration of being only to have a few close friends. Because of the way we're confined in space and time, there's only certain people you can get to spend quality time with over the course of your life. This is one of the frustrations I experience traveling around the world. I get to meet thousands of people, wonderful people, that I would love to spend time with, but there's no way I can get to them all. I have to confine myself to just a few. We all have to do that. Now, that's a frustration in terms of experiencing all the wonders of relationship. However, there's a benefit. It keeps us from committing the kind of evil that lurks in our heart. As it tells us in Jeremiah 17, no one can imagine how evil the human heart is. It's evil beyond anyone's capacity to imagine. And if it wasn't for the grace of God, that evil would sneak out and perpetrate a great harm. Our lifespans. I mentioned earlier that physical death is a gift. Now, a really good illustration of how physical death is a gift is what happened in the days before the flood of Noah, when people lived to be over 900 years. But the problem with a long lifespan is that it tilts the advantage to the wicked and away from the righteous. In this sense, if you've got, say, a serial killer on the loose, who are they going to kill? Other serial killers? No. No, they're too difficult to take care of. Rather, they prey on the righteous. And that's what happened in the days before the flood. Evil people preyed on the righteous, and because they were living 900 plus years, an evil person was able to do a lot of damage in the course of that life. And this is what happens with people who decide to follow, or to follow Satan rather than to follow Christ. As it tells us in 2 Thessalonians and 1 Thessalonians and in Timothy, that when you commit yourself to not follow God, but rather to follow Satan instead, you'll become progressively more and more evil as you get older and older. This is what reprobation is all about, blasphemy against the Holy Spirit. And when you have a reprobate living 800 years or 700 years, they can do a lot of damage. But they only live 60 or 70. But it also works the other way. 60, 70, 80 years is more than enough time, the way God has designed the physics of the universe, for anyone who's committed to his path of virtue to become established in that path of virtue. We don't need 900 years to establish the righteousness we have in Christ as we decide to follow him. We only need 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 years. That's adequate. And since the new creation is so much better than this, why hang around here any longer than necessary? Which brings me to my close here, and that is, okay, given that we have this thermodynamics, electromagnetism, gravity, what's it like in the new creation? Why does the text tell us it's radically different? All things will be new. Everything that's old will be passed away and replaced. But we're told it will begin at the conquest of evil. We are told it's not paradise. It's far better than paradise. The first creation will be removed. The universe will not exist. I have to realize all those beautiful galaxies I like to observe will never exist once evil is conquered. They'll be gone forever. And then as we enter this new creation, it's going to be a much larger habitat than what we face here. This planet Earth is only 8,000 miles in diameter. And we're all confined to the surface of the planet. One of the first things you see in Revelation 21 is that God's people are going to live in an apartment complex called the New Jerusalem. They'll reside on top of a new earth. We're not told how big the new earth is, but we are told how big the New Jerusalem is. Now, I don't know how many stories this building's going to have, but I like mountains, so I'm going to presume that each story is 2 miles high. That gives you lots of nice relief to have mountains and waterfalls and everything else that we can think of that would be glorious. And with ceilings 2 miles high, that means that the New Jerusalem all by itself will have about 10 times the living space of the entire surface of planet Earth. That's just the apartment complex. Then you get to roam over the whole of the new Earth, and the new heavens will be accessible to us. Right now, there are very few of us that can leave planet Earth. But in the new creation, the habitat space will be enormously expanded. We're told explicitly there will be no thermodynamics. A direct promise. Decay will be no more. Death will be no more. Pain will be no more. Suffering will be no more. Grief will be no more. All that will be gone. Now, we can blame a lot of that on thermodynamics. But with the conquest of evil, there's no longer any need for the thermodynamics. That law of decay is there to encourage us to leave evil and pursue virtue with God's help. New creation, no sin, no evil, no need for thermodynamics. We're told there'll be no gravity. You say, where does it say that? It describes this building, this apartment complex I was talking about. How big is it? 1,500 miles by 1,500 miles by 1,500 miles, and it's got corners. As a physicist, I can tell you that's impossible if gravity is operating in any way, shape, or form. There's a reason why all the big bodies in the universe are spherical in shape. Gravity forces anything that's big into a sphere, removes the corners. Well, this thing's a lot bigger than the minimum size in which you get the corners removed, which is about 200 or 300 miles. And we're told that there'll be no darkness. You know, this universe, as I said last time I spoke here, is 99.73% dark stuff. Only 0.27% stuff is light. The new creation is going to be 0% darkness and 100% light. Everything will glow with light. We're told there'll be no sun in the new creation. There'll be no stars in the new creation, because light will permeate the entirety of the new creation. There'll be no shadows, no darkness. This isn't electromagnetism. The property of the light that we're experiencing is that it casts shadows. And it's based on the fact that the universe is predominantly made up of dark stuff. This is very different. And it's a different dimensionality. Now, you notice that there is dimensionality in new creation. It talks about a measuring stick. There's this angel there with this stick that's about 2 meters long. And he's going around measuring things. We also see the New Jerusalem being described as dimensions. But I don't believe it's the space dimensions that we're experiencing, length, width, height. I see it as something that's bigger and better than that. Likewise, I don't think we'll any longer be confined to a single dimension of time. Time is what fundamentally keeps us apart from one another. In a new creation, God's going to remove all those barriers that keep us apart from one another. I believe at a minimum, God is going to grant us in the new creation access to at least the equivalent of 2 independent dimensions of time. And this is where a little bit of math kind of helps you out a little bit, okay? What can you do if you had access to 2 dimensions of time? Well, that means that you could have continual fellowship with your spouse. So it tells us in Revelation 22, there will be no marriage in heaven, no marriages, no families. All that will be gone. On the other hand, every Christian in a new creation will be able to spend continual time without interruption with her spouse. You can't do that in this creation. Right now, I'm separated from my wife. She's about 20 miles from here. We're out of contact with one another. We're out of contact with fellowship. And so our marriage is nowhere near the quality it's going to be in the new creation. New creation, I'll be able to spend all eternity, every second of it, with my wife, intimate conversation and fellowship with her. But you know what? I believe God is going to grant me and every other Christian that kind of relationship and fellowship with every other believer simultaneously. Can you think of the joy of that? Right now you've got, what, maybe 12 close friends maximum? In the new creation, you're going to have 40 or 50 billion close friends. And you're going to be able to spend time with them continuously without interruption. That's why it tells us in 1 Corinthians 2:9, no eye has seen, no ear has heard, no mind has conceived what God has prepared for those who love Him. Now, I'm just giving you kind of the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot more to it than that. In fact, John in Revelation makes it quite clear. I can't describe to you how good and great and wonderful the new creation will be. He gives us some hints, some suggestions. But no matter what we come up with, it's better than any one of us can think or imagine. Which is why the same Apostle Paul said, encourage each other with these words. Every day, spend some time meditating on how great your reward will be. It's also the same Apostle Paul who said, the pathway to a virtuous, righteous life is to fix your mind, your heart, and spirit on your future hope. As you look forward, that will give you the motivation, the Holy Spirit motivation, to live the Christian life. Thank you.